Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 28th. I'm Ray Graff. Time again for the Science Forum. Our panel of experts have reassembled, and they're ready to field your scientific questions. If you have one, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You could also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. And we have a few science questions already, but we're ready for more. You can also call us. That's right. It's a call-in show. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. We'll get to your questions and chatter with the scientists coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and the experts are ready to respond to your questions. If you have one, give us a call right now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, with your science question. No question is too simple or too hard. Well, some might be too hard, but we'll let you know. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551 for your calls. With that, let's have our esteemed panel of scientists sign in, please.
It's Barbara Brabets. I am a biochemist, and I teach at SUNY Cobleskill. We are currently out of session. It is summertime, time for meetings and research.
Lovely. And you've been on sabbatical anyway.
I have. So that's been research, no meetings. So now my summer is meetings and research. It's interesting because it just got worse, not better.
Are you going back in the...
I think it's the 27th of August. I'll have my my teacher clothes on, and I'll be ready in the classroom.
Did you enjoy your sabbatical?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure.
We'll talk about that. You have some stuff coming up. Two.
I do.
Who are you over there?
Roger Jaboni. I'm the owner of Rogers High Fidelity, and I'm an electrical engineer.
Great to have you back here in lovely New York State. And
Thank you. I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, and I am mostly retired.
You lucky dog. Barbara Brabets, before we get to something you have going on June 6th,
yes,
you mentioned something right before we hit the air about that phenomenon that affects some people where if you go into the really bright sun or a really bright light, you sneeze. And they've cracked this.
Well, we knew there was a genetic link because we would ask people, does this happen to you when you leave a movie theater and you go out into the bright sunshine, do you automatically sneeze? And they call it photic sneezing. And they found that there's a genetic link. What the question was is why does this happen? Because it seems like it's kind of like a short circuiting. And so what they did is they took people who, scientists, not just random people on the street, they took people who said, yes, this happens to me. And they did an imaging of the nerves, the cranial nerves that run both their nose and their eyes. Now, those are the optic nerve and the otic nerve. They're two different ones. And what happens is they're not really supposed to be right next to each other, even though there's not that much real estate in your head. But it turns out that in the people who have this phenomenon, those two relatively large, powerful nerves cross each other. And therefore, they think it's a feedback loop coming from overstimulation from the eyes is creating a feedback loop going down the nose, which is only supposed to receive information from the nose to the brain. But now the information is going from the brain to the nose, or not quite from the brain to the nose, and then making kind of like a... if you think of like a hiccup of the nose, which is a sneeze.
So the optic nerve needs more insulation.
One of the two of them do. Yes. Because
really,
but it's an overcharging of one leads to a backfeed on the other.
Is this related to synesthesia at all?
It probably is, although they haven't cracked that one. Is probably a more complex problem. But I was thinking, too, of why people with ophthalmic migraines that are triggered by light, often have smells that are associated with it, either phantom smells or smells can trigger the ophthalmic migraine. And I'm sure it's a similar phenomenon because the two are close together.
So we all need bigger heads with more space.
Or just more insulation.
I got plenty of space.
It's a Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Before we move to the emails, June 6th is National Trails Day, something I didn't know until about 2 minutes ago, but Barbara Bravitz is involved. Barbara.
Yes, part of my sabbatical, I've been doing water quality testing on the Mohawk River. I've been doing it for 12 years, but I've been doing more of it on sabbatical. And I'm going to be at National Trails Day at the Sanford Stud Farm Barn. There's a joke there. Just leave it alone.
I'll leave it alone.
Okay, and that's in Amsterdam on Route 30 near Walmart. It's the old stallion barns for a racing family. And the Friends of the North Chuctanunda Creek are holding kind of a fair, if you will. It's activities for all kids and adults. And I will be there. It's not a tilt-a-whirl, but it is water quality testing. So okay. I'm gonna have little water quality kits that people can take home to test their water, and then information about the local waterways in and around the Capital Region and their health.
You know, at my age, I can't do a tilt-a-whirl anymore. So
I do. It triggers a headache. So my ophthalmic migraine. Here.
The number to call here on the Science Forum as we get rolling is 800-348-2551. We have Barbara Bravitz, Roger Jaboney, and Jim Pickett with us today. Some emails came in, voxpop@wamc.org, and you can do it that way. This one's from Chris. Came in quite a while ago. On Earthwise, a fun little informational show on WAMC, a nuclear fusion plant northwest of Boston and affiliated with MIT was due to go online a year ago in June. I was wondering how it's going. Does anybody know anything about this?
Well, all I know about this is what I read on the internet.
Yeah.
I believe that it has been delayed. It's still under construction.
Yeah.
I think they are planning to turn the tokamak on still this year or next year.
So fusion.
It's tiny, though. It's not a large.
It's not a huge thing. And yeah. I don't believe it's intended to feed electricity into the grid. It's a matter of they're still scaling up the technology. What makes it different from others is that they're using high temperature superconductor tapes.
Tapes?
Well,
strips of things.
Strips that take that are the high temperature superconductor equivalent of wires.
Okay.
To wind the superconducting magnets so that they can make it all more compact. And that is supposed to
increase efficiency,
yeah. Make it easier to keep the plasma contained and under fusion conditions.
But this was not supposed to go online yet, was it?
2026, 2027 is what they're saying.
Really?
It should be producing net energy.
Yeah.
Okay, net energy means what?
More energy out than you have to put in to get it going. But
yes,
that's the
idea. That's the Holy Grail,
That's what we're all striving for with fusion.
Yes, and that all depends on how you're measuring it. If you're measuring it with the electricity that you take, for example, to keep things running, versus heat energy out, then break even is one thing. And it's easier to achieve. If, however, then you, from that heat, you're going to generate more electricity, things just got a factor of two or three more difficult to actually produce net power.
And Jim, you worked in industry, and Roger, you worked in research. So you understand the issues that even if you have a technology that works, getting to the point where it's as efficient as is practicable is something that takes much more than months. Like I'm a biochemist. I have worked in industry where you're trying to make a product and you want to make that product as efficiently as possible because you're going to generate waste, because there's cost involved in the raw ingredients. Getting to that point where you have dialed in that really does take years. So I can't imagine with a new technology like fusion, trying to get to net energy by 2026, 2027, that looks great on paper, but the scientist in me says, good luck, guys.
Yeah, but there's no question. Fusion technology has really pushed that can down the road.
Oh, yeah. It's possible.
Much longer than a lot of other technologies have.
Yeah. I mean, we get calls all the time about Carnot engines and other types of, on paper, it looks like you could get more out of it than you put in, but this is the only one that really makes
been
sense.
It's always been not quite in our grasp.
Well, now the first hydrogen bomb was what, 49? When did we first do that?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
that's right.
Why is it much easier to make fusion and release vast amounts of energy than to control it
You got to contain it.
Yeah. Explosion versus fire. There's a difference, right?
Yeah. And the conditions under which fusion take place are just unimaginably severe.
Yeah.
Complex.
And,
right.
You know, you can generate those conditions with a fission nuclear bomb, or you can generate those conditions under very intense gravity in the core of the sun. Doing it in a building.
Doing it in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah. It's actually Devens.
It's a little different. Devens, is it? Yeah, is that where they're putting it?
Is probably a bit of next to the prison.
Is a bit of a trick. And again, my kind of skeptical obstreperous. You used that word once.
Obstreperous, yes, indeed.
Nature says, we've got a perfectly good fusion reactor in the form of the sun.
Yeah.
And we know how to gather the energy from that.
But it's not that efficient, right?
Sure it is.
You mean solar panels?
30%.
Sure, because they're up to, I mean, the commercial panels are, what, 20% or more now?
Yeah,
they've got them in the high 20s, yeah. Low 30s.
And you got to consider getting from the heat of a fusion reactor to electricity. If they break 35%, they're doing very well.
Okay. As long as it doesn't blow up, I'm good with this. We can try. Nick writes in, I can walk on a curb that's 8 inches wide with no problem if it's almost ground level. If I'm on a scaffold or platform that is 2 feet wide but 10 feet up, totally different feeling, even though it's 3 times wider. Is it the gravity that makes it harder or just our perception?
It's two things, really. It's our perception, right? There's the anxiety of, you know, this could hurt. Especially as we get older, I find that, you know, pickleball is a little bit more scary now than it would have been when I was like 25.
You play pickleball?
I try.
Do you?
Yeah. More, and then my MD friends say, you know, we see more pickleball injuries than we do like car accidents.
Oh, you're kidding.
So I'm like,
I actually had a friend that was in the FDNY, and he said they trained them to walk on roofs that are on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They would build roofs on the ground, and they train you to walk up and down a roof. On the ground.
To get over the anxiety.
You got on the building, you could do it.
So it's anxiety, really.
It's not gravity. The other issue is a curb is like fastened to the ground, right?
Right.
A scaffold has a shakeability to it, right? And that shakeability you have to be able to deal with. That's why a tight walker, people will pay to watch a tight walker.
Yeah.
When they're up in the air.
I can't watch that.
Yeah.
Now,
I'm afraid they're going to fall.
You know, slack lines, there's a thing called a slack line, which is like way beyond pickleball, which is where you take, it looks like kind of like a fireman's hose. That's deflated, and then you tie it tight between two trees, and then you try to walk it like it's a tightrope. This is what young people do.
Well, you've had way too long of a sabbatical. I got to be honest.
Well,
with
I
you.
Did not slackline
okay,
on my
good.
Sabbatical.
Oh,
otherwise, I'd be in here with broken everything.
Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. We'll do a little couple more emails, and then we'll get to the phones. 800-348-2551. Little Levin Brothers for you. Have at it. Hey, folks, the lockbox is open. We're doing really well. You have really stepped up. I think we're over 412,000. I might be wrong about that number, but you can make your pledge anytime to WAMC at our website, wamc.org. Secure online pledge right there. Fill that lockbox, and we'll shorten the drive, which begins June 1st at 6 a.m., and I'll be there with you. And don't worry, we'll have some anyway. Okay, a couple more emails here, and then we'll get back to the calls here on the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Roger Jaboni are with us. 800-348-2551 is the number. All right, this is from Rick in Belchertown. In a recent Science Forum, Dr. Brabets revealed a very simple way to release peanut butter from the inside of the jar, which I felt may enhance the possibility of the jar being recycled when plastic is being sorted. Unfortunately, time being what it is, my old cranium can't remember what she said. Well, I'm with you there. Please reiterate, Barb, and that's from Rick.
So Science Forum, like, best requests.
Yes.
Yes, it was to add a dishwasher, some dishwashing liquid for the dishwasher to it. It has enzymes in it that break down the fats that are in the peanut butter. It works well with the mayonnaise jars, and it works well with the peanut butter jars. I buy those pods, and I won't give you a brand name, but, you know, even a store value pod that you would throw into your dishwasher. I put a pod in. I know it's a lot of liquid or a lot of detergent for one thing, but I don't want to have to go buy the powder just to pour a little bit of powder in. But anyway, it works great.
Okay.
You just leave it overnight, and then the next day, you rinse it out. You're done.
All right. Well, we've settled that. All right, one more email for now, and we'll get to more emails in a bit. This is from Mac in Western Massachusetts. Color questions. One, how do LED lights emit different colors from the same bulb?
Because there are multiple LEDs in there.
Yeah, it's not. It's technically it's one bulb, but it's multiple little diodes that are within the little encasement. So it's like having all of your crayons under one globe.
Oh, interesting.
So you just activate them.
I was of the impression that there are certain diode junctions, as you change the current through the diode junction, the emission color changed on it.
Well, that's interesting. I think that would be more expensive. So I think that it depends on your color fastness or how much range you need in your LED, because certain LEDs, you don't need a lot of range. Like, I'm thinking of, you can buy the bulb that you put in your regular socket that has a remote control to it. So you can kind of remote control, and then you can turn your room into a disco and turn it blue, or you can make it white or whatever. There's usually 12 colors. But then I see other things that are like, you have 128,000 color options. And then I think you're probably talking about a little bit more sophisticated diodes.
All right. One more question from Mac, and then we'll get to the phones. 800-348-2551, the number, here on the Science Forum with Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboni, and Barbara Brabets. Mac writes, the second question, why is the moon orange when low in the sky?
That's a great question. It has to do with the fact that you're looking through more atmosphere when you're going horizontal, right? You're at the horizon and you're looking up just a bit from the horizon, but the thickness of our atmosphere is thickest there because it's traveling as long as your eyes can see, versus if it's up straight, you're just doing a straight shot up through the skin, if you will, of the atmosphere.
Right.
And because of that, there's more pollution, first off, in the lower parts of the atmosphere, the kind that would turn something a color, like some of the NOxes. So nitrogen-containing compounds tend to have an orange hue, especially if they've been exposed to sunlight that day. So it just kind of puts an orange filter over what the moon would normally look like. Okay. So the moon itself isn't orange.
But just the larger amount of Rayleigh scattering.
Right, yeah, right. That comes from the pollutants that are in the atmosphere.
Sunrise and sunset. It's just reflected light off the moon.
Okay, and then, of course, I think the more interesting question, and this is, I guess, just perception, as we have learned the astronomy, is that it appears much bigger on the horizon.
Right.
You get up in the middle and sky, and it looks not as significant.
You know, how many times have I heard this, right?
Yeah.
And I still put my finger out, and then I look at it, and I put my finger out again, and it's like, I can't believe it, but boy, my brain is tricked. All I need is a couple of mountains or a tree, and I think it's gigantic.
Yeah, it's a very convincing illusion.
Yeah.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get back to the emails a little later in the show. It's Barbara Brabets, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett. And let's begin in Bearsville with Mary. Hello, Mary, you're on.
Hi, my name is Mary Frank. I'm an artist and I'm an activist. And I've worked as a volunteer for over 20 years for an organization you may not know about, but which is a piece of rare good news. It's called Solar Cookers International.
Oh.
And now more than 21 million people are using them around the world.
Cool.
In front of the UN, we cooked meat, fish, bread, rice, beans, purified water.
Nice.
In front of 37 people from 37 different countries with tears in their eyes as they got to taste it.
Was it good?
And they give the design free. You can make one yourself. Takes you half an hour. You use an old cardboard box. You do have to buy aluminum, paper.
All right, well, let's have let's have the scientists quiz you a little bit about how these things work. Barbara, do you have any questions
for
Mary?
So, Mary, I understand it sounds like it's a solar oven. Where you're kind of capturing the light of the sky while you have it, and then cooking in sunlight. So it does well for daytime meals. It really won't work for nighttime meals, correct?
No, but in many countries, in African countries, they make baskets and they put the food they've cooked during the day, and they put like a pillow of whatever, you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah, just kind of, you know, we don't all have to have hot food.
Keep it warm.
Right. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. But it's a huge effect on climate crisis. I hate the word climate change. Sounds like okay. You're going to change a cup of coffee.
Right.
And because then women are not going to, you know, they used to walk 10 miles to get wood. Excuse me. Now they walk 20. They can't walk 20 back. They sleep out. Men rape them because they know they're sleeping out.
All right, Mary. Well, thank you.
So many things.
Appreciate it. How do people find out more about this?
Go to Solar Cookers International.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for the call. Really appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Science Forum today. Roger Jaboney, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabitz. And let's see. Let's go to Brattleboro. Joyce, you're on.
Hi, this is Joyce from Brattleboro, Vermont.
Right.
Even on NPR, they have been talking frequently in the last week about geoengineering and the chemical aerosol aerial operation that's apparently going on via the Gates Foundation, putting chemicals in the air to block the solar rays to help climate change. I have a lot of patients who are getting sick hours before rain fronts and weather fronts. And Dane Whittington from Geoengineering Watch has indicated that it's the chemicals in the air. I'm wondering whether you can comment on that.
Well, we have people who know chemistry quite well here. Let's go with Jim Pickett first.
As far as I know, any deliberate putting aerosols into the air for climate change or to reflect the sunlight, at most has been done on very, very small scale. I am not aware of there being any large scale experiments like that. And what it is usually putting sulfur containing compounds high in the atmosphere. You want them high up so they don't just rain back down.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't believe this is being practiced at any scale.
Barbara, you know anything of this?
I haven't. I've been listening to NPR pretty regularly on my sabbatical, and unfortunately I've missed the content that Mary talks about.
It's probably because we were in the lockbox segments.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, maybe. What I can say is that if this is true, then I'm sure we'll hear more about it.
All right. The number is 800-32. Nope, that's the fun
that,
drive
yeah,
number.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm already getting to that point where I can't remember the number. It's 800-348-2551 if you want to call this program. Don't worry about the fun drive number right now, but you can make a pledge at WAMC.org. Joyce, thanks for that call. Appreciate it very much. Roger Jaboney is here, and Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabitz. You know anything about this, chemical spraying in the atmosphere, Roger?
No, I don't. But Jim's got it down pat.
Talking about
putting sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere to reduce it. There are lots of risks associated with it. None of them seem to be health risks that I've seen.
Okay.
Well, if it's high up, there's not a health risk. But sulfur dioxide in the lower atmosphere does cause acid rain.
Doesn't Venus have this issue where the sulfuric acid comes down from the sky as rain?
It's true.
It's a runaway greenhouse effect.
It's actually more just their clouds are sulfuric acid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a lovely place to visit.
Yeah, real estate's cheap there.
It's Science Forum today, 800-348-2551. Doug is in Lenox. Doug, go.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm
interested. It's funny you talked about clouds, and my question is about clouds.
Okay.
When you're flying in an airplane, you're coming along, you're up above the clouds, and then you come down and you go through these clouds. They have very defined walls and they're very thick. What makes clouds stay together? What makes them bunch up the way they do and not just disperse throughout the atmosphere?
Well, the clouds are formed by moisture and particulate matter that the moisture adheres to, and then the clouds form where the temperature and the dew point equal. So when you hit the temperature and the dew point to be the same number, that's your base layer of clouds. Then you can get clouds above that, cumulus clouds, which are a result of buildups, convective activity, that kind of thing, thunderstorms.
They seem to have very defined walls, like when you're flying in the plane, all of a sudden, you go into it, and you look at it, and they seem, I mean, I know they're not solid because the airplane goes through it, but they seem
right.
quite.
They do, and that's how, as a pilot, we know where the base layer of the clouds is. We know what the temperature and the dew point are. We can tell you where the base layer of the clouds is.
But you are correct that the walls are pretty defined. If you think about water in the liquid phase, if we had a puddle of water that's on a nice clean surface like the hood of your car or on a piece of lawn furniture, you'll see that it beads up into this very circular, very defined, with a very sharp boundary droplet. There's a bunch of different chemical and physical properties that make that happen. But one of the key pieces of that is that water molecules are attracted through space in the short distance, like when they're close together, to other water molecules. And it's called hydrogen bonding. And so what that does is it kind of takes water that's on a molecular level somewhat dispersed, and it orients it in a certain way.
But that's not what's holding the cloud.
No, but that's one of the ways that water finds itself, if you will.
So the individual droplets are defined that way. But as Roger's saying, it's defined by the temperature and humidity conditions. So where there is that, like on the top of the cloud, that is where it has moved outside of the temperature and humidity conditions that will support having the liquid droplets there or ice crystals there.
Doug, does this make sense to you?
Yeah, it kind of makes sense.
Well, I mean, temperature, and the reason they form above you is because temperature decreases at the adiabatic lapse rate's about 2 degrees C per 1,000 feet.
I'm sorry, what was that?
The adiabatic, the linear lapse rate of temperature is about 2 degrees C per 1,000 feet.
Is this going to be on the test?
It might be.
It's already been.
Oh, boy.
So that's how it forms. So the temperature goes down as you go up in altitude, and the atmosphere has so much moisture in it. So when the temperature and dew point hit the same point, the cloud forms. The moisture condenses.
Aha.
And we always have movement because there's wind of some sort, right? So we always have this dynamic effect.
Go ahead, Doug.
If you take the temperature in the clear air and then you fly into the cloud, the temperature will drop when it gets in the cloud?
Or the relative humidity goes up.
Not necessarily. I mean, you do get air mass variations, temperature variations, but generally not. It's more to Barbara's point that you get coagulation of humidity in the air, moisture in the air, and dust particles that they can accumulate to.
All right, Doug, thanks for the call. It's the Science Forum today. Barbara Brabitz is here, just wrapping up the old sabbatical, getting ready to go to the classroom. Roger Jaboney from Roger's High Fidelity is here, and Jim Pickett, who is super relaxed, man, just retired and loving life. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question for our panel, and let's go. Let's take one more call.
Well, before we take one more call, let's just acknowledge that our friend Ed Stander is not here for a very rare vacancy. He does not take vacation very often.
I didn't want to mention it because I didn't want to embarrass him, but I don't recall him ever bagging out of a show.
No, I think he told you months ago he couldn't be here. So he's out of the area on vacation.
It's okay.
We're all adjusting.
I'm a little bitter, but I think it'll be all right. Let's go to Chris in Housatonic, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, my name's Chris.
Yes.
I was wondering, I don't know if you guys are related to the SR-71. It's a reconnaissance plane.
Yeah, but I know it well.
When it was operational. Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
It outraced the sun a number of times. No other aircraft could do.
It outraced the sun, you're saying?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. And so the sun transiting across the sky is what you presumably mean. Okay. What's the question, Chris?
Is there another airplane that can be like that, like the SR, in our lifetime?
Okay. That's a fast plane. It always perplexed me why they retired that one.
Well, it's because it cost more than a squadron of F-35s to maintain one of them.
And so that went Mach 6?
The speeds are still classified.
Yeah. And so it...
And spy satellite technology basically...
Drone technology has changed the game. Even satellites are becoming outdated today. But the SR-71 is a very unique aircraft. It was not even on the drawing boards until Gary Powers was shot down in a U-2. Right? You remember that over Russia?
Was 1961 or was it?
61 or 62. Gary Powers was shot down. Within 18 months, the Lockheed Skunk Works, a guy by the name of Kelly Johnson.
Yep, famous.
That's when they used slide rules to design airplanes, not computers, designed the SR-71, which to this date, to my knowledge, holds the speed record.
And this thing went 3,000 miles an hour or something?
I don't know.
We don't know. It's all speculation.
Now, the country, our nation, is about 3,000 miles wide, right?
Right.
How do you slow down in time to land?
There's a lot of logistics associated with it. There's a lot of other logistics. As a matter of fact, the wing temperatures, it was the first aircraft to be built out of all titanium.
And
the wing temperatures were so high that they ran the fuel through the wing leading edges to cool them.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. And the SR-71 literally had to refuel shortly after takeoff because it would leak fuel sitting on the runway.
You're kidding me.
And subsonic, it flew much different than supersonic. I remember they designed it completely for supersonic flight. And the things I've read, in books with covers, is that it was just a piece of junk below in subsonic range, and then supersonic, it tightened up.
What you may find interesting is they still fly the U-2. It's now,
after
Powers was shot down, it was renamed the TR-1.
Oh, right. I didn't realize
But they, they used the TR-1s over Iran.
And this was, for a brief period of time, the SR-71 was taken out of mothballs for the first Iraq War, I believe.
I don't know. That sounds internet-ish to me.
Well, I don't know.
No, okay.
That news goes back
to
before
30 years
the internet.
Ago, guys.
I don't know.
So, yeah.
The number here is 800-348-2551. I have another question about the SR-71, but we're going to take a break. First, 800-348-2551, Science Forum. And you can email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll check the email bag in a minute. Yeah, buddy. It's Johnny Hammond Smith, Soul Talk here on Vox Pop. Hey, the lockbox is open. Please make a pledge if you haven't done it yet. It's WAMC.org. Every dollar counts, and we could use your support right now if you value anything you hear at this station. You're in, and we just need you. If you have the scratch to throw a couple bucks in, and you know there are times I don't have the scratch to throw a couple bucks in, but if you have it, love it if you did it. WAMC.org. It's a science forum. And we have Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets, and Roger Jaboni. And just one more question on the SR-71 before we hit the email bag again. You mentioned that the top speed is still classified all these years later.
And I just looked it up. They're saying they're classifying it as Mach 3 plus.
Okay.
But they don't tell you specifically what its speed
is. Okay, fair enough. How about its ceiling? How about its altitude?
It's classified, but they call it 85,000 feet.
Okay.
Jeez, now, there's not a lot of oxygen up there. Boy, oh boy.
All right. And I often...
Well, they wore pressure suits when they flew.
No, I meant for the combustion reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the jet fuel.
And so does Bernoulli's principle still hold when there's no air?
There's stuff there. It starts
to get challenged.
Yeah. there's nitrogen still up there. So you still have... quote unquote air, but you don't have the stuff for combustion, right? You need oxygen in order to burn fuel.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they have to use specialized fuel when they're at that type of altitude.
It is a special fuel.
Yeah.
I always wondered, you know, they talked about, go ahead, Jim, you wanted to say something?
No. I mean, the oxygen nitrogen ratio is the same.
Oh,
up
so
there.
It's just lower
pressure.
Right.
And the aerodynamics work up to the Kármán line, which is 60 some miles.
Okay, so it would still be tenable to get a plane that went even higher than 85,000 feet.
Yes.
Question about helicopters on Mars. Now, I think there was a local, maybe it was RPI, somebody.
Oh, wait, weren't we going to talk about chasing the sun before we go to helicopters?
Oh, you can do that, but now I'll forget my question. But go ahead.
Okay, we'll try to remind you. To chase the sun, you know, the diameter or the circumference of the Earth is about 24,000 miles. So to chase the sun going in that direction, it'd only be about 1,000 miles an hour. I mean, I say only, but that means that in 3 hours,
it's less than Mach 1.
Okay.
Yeah,
at that altitude.
Right.
So a lot of planes could do that.
Right.
All right. So
But the SR-71, the, he peeled a very interesting onion there. It's an interesting aircraft. That's and the associated spy satellites, which was the Corona program,
yep.
which was being developed at the same time,
and
which dropped film
ago.
Canisters
yes.
in yep. in for reentry.
And that's such a great story too. What's the book? There's a great book about all of those early satellites and getting the information back, and it was all shot on film because the resolution was so good. All right, getting back to my question, which has now been waylaid to some extent. We were talking about flying very high up in the atmosphere. There was a college recently, fairly recently, that sent a project up, a little mini helicopter. It was RPI that was deployed on Mars or would be deployed on Mars.
I remember that.
Now, the air being so thin, how would you have a helicopter work?
By having the blades go really, really
Speed.
Fast.
Yeah, super light.
Too. Yeah, and the super light, the little helicopter that was on Mars.
Yeah.
There were two counter-rotating blades so that they didn't need a tail fan to cancel out the torque.
Right.
And the blades are designed for high efficiency, and they were spun really, really
so
fast.
So it could work.
Yes. Oh, it does work. Yeah.
Another interesting helicopter design. This one will probably get Jim going too. Is the when they rescued the downed airmen in Iran, they had collapsible helicopters that went together like transformers. They had three of them on board a Sikorsky, and they pulled them out. Remember, they went in with helicopters to get them, but they landed in Iran, unloaded these, unfolded them like transformers, flew them. And
dude, they had that in 1965 when they made James Bond, or 67 when they made You Only Live Twice. He had a little helicopter that little Nelly unfolded and flew around. All right, I have a lot of questions about stealth helicopters too, but we're not going to talk about stealth helicopters. We're going to go to the email
bank. Stealth is an interesting technology.
Especially in a helicopter, right?
Yeah, because anything.
It's radar cross-section. So it's and it's not absorption, it's reflection.
Yes.
I mean the sound. They can deaden
sound.
The sound, I think they rotate the blades intentionally slow, and they have sound deadening on them. I believe they run the blades slower.
All right, so let's go to the email bag because I'm, once again, taking the whole show up. All right, here we go. 800-348-2551 if you want to call in the Science Forum with Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Roger Ciboney. Here's a weird one from Andrew. Can artificial intelligence make dumb people smart? Don't laugh, Graf. How's about brain implants? Kind of like a software update? That's from Andrew.
Well,
isn't that what the Neuralink
is? It's a great question, but then what is smart? Is smart information retrieval? Because I know some great people who could, score 16 wins on Jeopardy. Who are great at information retrieval, but it's the synthesis of information that's supposed to make AI better. And then how do you control the flow, right?
Right
now, AI is kind of like a request and you get it back, at least from our perspective. And I think in business, it's the same thing. We ask them for something, they churn it, and then they give it back. But what if to go to the point where all filtering is done by that AI as to what is retrieved, how it's retrieved, when it's appropriate.
AI. Now you have agentic AI.
Yeah.
Where agentic AI is actually putting thoughts together and
and
acting
prompts.
On behalf of them.
Oh. Yes. And that's the part
they're actually building chips
I think Jim's being skeptical again. Go ahead.
No, I worry more about AI making smart people dumb.
There you go.
Or making dumb people think they're smart.
There was an interesting article in Scientific American, and it referred to something which I had read earlier, in which a researcher deliberately put some disinformation about they made up a disease. It was pigmentation of the eyelids from being in front of computer monitors too long. And she had a great name for this. She wrote a preprint of a paper that was obviously bogus.
Yeah.
I mean, she made it so that anybody with a high school education would know that this paper was bogus.
Okay.
Put it on a preprint server, fed it with a couple of social media mentions, and it was picked up by AI. And answering medical questions. AI absolutely could not distinguish that this was bogus. I mean, it was an experiment to see if AI would do it.
And teach it.
They took it hook, line, and sinker.
There's simple things that AI gets wrong, too. I have an Alexa at my home, and I typically ask for the weather at certain points of my morning to kind of know what to expect. And I'll get this kind of pro forma, here's the low, here's the high, here's the projected, you know, precipitation. And I asked her just before I asked the weather question what temperature it was. It was like 32. And she said the low today will be from 45 to 78. And I'm like, but Alexa, it's 32 right now. Isn't the low today at least 32? And she started arguing with me.
Oh.
I mean, nicely, because, you know, Amazon wants me to still deal with Alexa. But, but you know, I have...
They're called hallucinations.
Well, I mean, that's not even a hallucination to me. That's just a mistake, like a simple mathematical mistake. I've done genealogical research, and I've asked to try to find vital statistics for long-dead people as a means of retrieval, quick retrieval. And they've made up people that do not exist. And that is a hallucination. And so that's very, I mean, it's not dangerous for my hobby, but it's dangerous in the sense that, you know, somebody could take that away and say, oh, there was an Uncle Julio.
Yeah,
and
you actually have, like, to be, no, Uncle you have to Julio. Be very smart to use AI.
Skeptical.
Well, yeah, smart or skeptical. But to know when, to be able to recognize when they're feeding you hallucinations.
Yeah.
Because I ran into a similar problem. It had to do with transcribing a document script.
Yes. And it
just made stuff up. Things that could plausibly had been in there.
Right.
But weren't. And if I hadn't read this for myself, I never would have discovered that it had made these sentences up and just inserted them.
Well, it gets bonus points for creativity,
yes.
Right?
Can I make one observation that I think is amazing with AI? And that is facial recognition. It used to be that whatever servers that were out there that were, you know, holding your photos for you on the cloud, they would try to identify people that were the same and ask you questions, is this person, right? And then if they had a beard or if it was a side profile, they had real trouble with it. And now I'm finding that if I have an adult photo of someone, and then I upload a child photo of that same person without any information, they'll figure out that that's the person.
Well, that's
as a
terrifying,
child.
Isn't it?
That's like prepubescence. Like, I can't even tell sometimes. So I find that amazing because that's very analog. It's very hard for that to be digital.
Okay.
It's an interesting phenomenon.
I don't like it. I don't like it at all. You know what? We're all going to be slaves to these things.
Wait till you see Uncle Julio's photos that the AI picks up, and he doesn't even exist.
Frank writes in, archaeologists, biologists, geologists, many other scientists often speak of discoveries from millions of years ago. Much of this is determined by carbon dating. In math class, we're taught to double-check our work the old-fashioned way. But without having a time machine, how can anyone actually, truly double-check carbon dating? None of us were around millions of years ago. How can we be sure? That's from Frank.
Right. Carbon dating is good for thousands of years. It's not good for millions of years. The reason why is the half-life of this carbon, the isotope of carbon, is about 9,000 years. So you're going to take that particular type of carbon, and in 9,000 years, you're going to have half of it the way you do. We can look at that graphically and in the short term over a year or two and watch that decay. And then the math of that, of the slope of that line, we can interpret that out to thousands of years. There are other isotopes besides carbon that we can use for millions of years. So when we go to like the geologic record, we tend to use more metals than we do carbon.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
And things are often checked by multiple methods. And the geological layering, which is from where the names of eras come from. Once that's reliably dated at one point, that same age is going to be true for something far away, where you may not be able to do the dating by, say, isotope methods someplace far away, but you're in that same geological layer.
I'll wait for Ed to be back, but I have questions about this geological layer thing. Like, how far down do they, what's the lowest down?
They call it basement rock.
Okay, how far down is that?
Well, it's not very, most of it's gone. We can't find it, but the Laurentian Shield, so up past the St. Lawrence, is some of the oldest rock on the planet, and it's at the surface because of all the crap that's happened after it was laid down.
Okay. Let's just go to the...
That's totally Ed's backyard.
Yeah, we'll talk to Ed about that next time. Terry in Pittsfield, I was reading about the Atlantic Meridian Ocean Current, I think it was, and was wondering what actually makes cold water heavier than warm water. Is there something physically different? And that's from Terry in Pittsfield.
It's just a matter of the thermal expansion coefficient of water. So most things, as it gets colder, as they get colder, they contract, they shrink.
The molecules get closer together. Because the atoms get closer together.
That's right. Because the temperature is molecular motion. So as things get colder, they rattle around less and thereby take up less space. So cold water will be denser than warmer water to a point.
Like
because water's weird. But in general, almost everything shrinks as it gets colder.
So the point is what? Freezing?
So you get what do you mean point?
Well, you said up to a point.
Oh, 4 degrees Celsius.
To just above the freezing point. And,
for water.
And then water starts to expand again.
Why? Why is it different? Why
because
is
it? Because water forms these regular repeating patterns because of that hydrogen bonding I talked about earlier.
Yeah.
So it kind of, instead of it, all the people crammed in the elevator as close as they possibly could be, they start making regular repeating patterns like snowflakes do. Right. So they have these hexagonal shapes of the way the water molecules are oriented to each other in order to lower their overall energy and maximize the attraction.
And nothing else does this in the natural world?
No, there are others that do it, but water is one of the peculiar big ones.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. One more email here, or maybe two, and then we're going to wrap it on the science forum. On photic sneezing. This is from Carl. Curious as to how an oculomotor nerve, instead a sensory nerve, optic, can cause the effect.
That's exactly right. That's why they think it's a feedback on a sensory nerve that is creating, exactly that.
Okay.
Right? So it's kind of like static on a phone line. Like, you get it. It's not supposed to be there, but you're getting feedback because there's an overwhelming signal nearby.
All right. Here's a question about helium from my friend John down in the 845, I think.
Yeah, save your helium.
Why does inhaling helium make our voices sound funny?
Well, because the density of helium is much less than the density of air. And our muscles are designed to vibrate within the density of the substance that we breathe every day, which is air. So when we're breathing in something that's less dense than that, those muscles are meant, they're already tuned to do a certain type of movement. And with less resistance, because the density is less, they move much more. That's the best I can
obviously
do.
Obviously a Grateful Dead fan down in the 845.
I have a feeling you might be right.
But save your helium, folks. Like, you're going to need it.
I seem to recall there was a gas that, when inhaled, makes your voice lower.
Argon is the
argon
one people use mostly. Yes.
And you're saying save the helium because it's coming out of the Middle East? Is that
the way
it's you're saying
just that, you know, you don't get it back, right? Once we let it go, it's gone. And there's only limited stock. It's going to be the next oil, if you will.
We're going to the moon. We'll get the helium-3,
H3. Yes, yeah. We've all watched For All Mankind, yes.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Oh, yeah, you should watch it.
A good movie?
It's a series on Apple.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe I'll subscribe someday. Hey, if you want to put your money where your mouth is, WAMC.org is the place to go. Our lockbox is open, and any amount is just fine with us. We won't cancel your subscription. 800. I won't give the phone number for the fun drive. I'm saving that for next week. Oh, it's been a long day. Roger Jaboney, how do people find Roger's High Fidelity?
RogersHighFidelity.com.
Jim, does anybody want to find you now that you're retired?
Not as far as I know.
All right, fair enough.
The IRS.
Barbara Bravitz, your lovely college.
Yes, SUNY Cobleskill, and I'll be in Amsterdam at the Stanford Stud Farm on Saturday, June 6th from 10 to 2.
And send me that link soon, and I'll put it on the page
already.
Today. All right, thanks a lot. Support comes from the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. And WAMC underwriters, businesses, and organizations that have made vital contributions to support the mission of WAMC. More on partnerships at WAMCunderwriting.org. And, you know, we talk a lot about you, the member, and how you keep us going. And we do it all together, and we have one mission. Underwriters are a huge part of that. And so a big shout-out to all of our underwriters. All right, thanks to Mike Bowen's the engineer. Hi, Mike. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, cookbook author Bruce Weinstein will be back. This time we talk about food myths. Does yogurt make your hair turn blue? I don't know. We'll find out tomorrow at 2.